This is Music Respawn. I'm Kate Remington with Gareth Coker, and it's going to be so much fun to get caught up.
Yes, it is. Nice to be back. It's been a while, but I've been doing a few things since I was last on.
Yeah, a few things. I have been so looking forward to talking with you about the music for Ori and the Will of the Wisps. Probably not as long as you've been waiting to get it out there, right?
It's been a pretty long journey, even longer than planned, with all the delays, which were necessary. I am glad that we delayed the game. It's one of those things we just needed to take the time to make it right. I think what a lot of people don't understand when they see Ori is they're like, oh, it's just a simple side-scrolling platform, and the game is very, very much more than that. And if you change one thing, it has a knock-on effect on so many other things. You're kind of trying to build the most stable house of cards ever, except fundamentally it can still feel like a house of cards sometimes.
That is a great analogy. It's such a bigger game. I've just been loving it. And the worlds, the way that they've created the world so that they're really three-dimensional seeming and having such a bigger scale for the game. I mean, in one way, it must have been great to have a way bigger playground for your music, but also you've got to fill that space, right?
So the DNA for the soundtrack was kind of set with the first game, which is pretty much wall-to-wall music. So of course, bigger game, I can't really change the DNA too much because there is a certain expectation for what a sequel should be. But on the one hand, it looks like a lot of work, but on the other, the environments are all so different and there are so many more characters and there's a wider variety of gameplay, the boss fights, the chase sequences, and the regular moment-to-moment gameplay, that actually it was, even though there was more music to do, I felt like I had more places to go.
Oh, yeah. It must have been really fun to have so many more characters. And what has really struck me is that they're all so fleshed out. They've just got so much personality. And it must have been just really fun to bring them to life with your music, especially like Koo, little Koo, the owl chick.
Yeah, so obviously, you know, Ori's back, but in the first game, we really spend like 98% of the time with Ori, and after the opening, Naru and Gumo are pretty, actually you don't meet Gumo until like halfway through Act 1 of the first game, but you don't see much of Gumo, you don't see much of Naru, and you don't see much of Kuro in the game either, whereas this, you're kind of with the additional characters a lot more, which gave me a chance to actually develop some secondary themes, which if I was to nitpick the first soundtrack, it is almost too reliant on one theme, but I will always defend that because the game is reliant on one character. So this time around we have Koo's theme, which is obviously all over the prologue and in the initial like environment music, the Inkwater Marsh, which on the soundtrack is separated by the storm. That's a sad version of Koo's theme that you hear in the flight sequence. And there are select other tracks throughout the soundtrack which reference Koo's theme for story reasons, which I'm not going to spoil because we're still relatively close to the release of the game, just in case people haven't played it.
Yeah, I'm not even all that
okay,
far
good.
In it. Yes.
Okay. Then my favorite non-playable character in the game is Quolok, who is the giant toad. This was an interesting one to explore for me because I wanted, as soon as I saw the concept for Quirlock, I was like, okay, this needs to be a bass instrument. No one ever does melodies in the bass for like long periods of time. So what can we actually do that will sound like Ori, but not feel too heavy and oppressive, because it is a bass instrument, but Ori's environmental music can't really be heavy and oppressive unless it's thematically appropriate. And I eventually settled on bass clarinet, which you can hear in the Quirlock's Hollow track and Dashing and Bashing and The Eyes of Quirlock, and a couple of other related tracks which you'll hear down the line, which would be spoilery if I mentioned why they occur. But it was really fun to be able to actually give a bass instrument a melody for an extended period of time. And I go right to the bottom of the bass clarinet's range. There's only one note left that the bass clarinet can go to, and it's just really satisfying hearing the second lowest note, which is it's the very first note of the melody, actually, is the second lowest note on the bass clarinet, and it just makes it immediately identifiable. And then when you actually get to meeting Quirlock, you kind of have to do a whole bunch of gameplay before you meet Quirlock. That isn't really a spoiler. When you actually meet Quirlock, you finally get the theme in its full form with the whole orchestra. But up until then, you only hear it in the bass clarinet in Quirlock's actual environment. So that was a fun one to explore. I'm gonna run through the themes here if you
sure.
don't mind.
Yeah, that would be fun.
So okay. So Shriek is the main antagonist of this game. She is much more prevalent earlier on in the game. Although her theme you really only start to hear when you enter the Silent Woodlands, and there's a very, very great sequence. It's one of the things I'm most proud of as being part of the studio, where Ori's theme, Ku's theme, and Shriek's theme combine. It's the track Ash and Bone on the soundtrack. Again, for gameplay and story reasons, I won't tell you why they combine, but it's a long sequence in the game that is very cinematic, and it was an opportunity to actually try and combine three themes. Thank you. Shriek's theme is pretty simple. It really is just a descending. It is a descending scale, except the second note rises. So only the first or second note rises, and then everything else goes down. It is almost too simple, but again, for story reasons, Shriek's a slightly more one-dimensional character, at least as it first appears. But as you play through the game, you understand Shriek's motivations for feeling the way she does. I think finally the spider.
That's a terrifying track. Oh my god!
more of the spider. So you first hear her theme in the Shadows of Moldwood track, which is the environment that precedes the boss fight with more of the spider. And her theme is there, is just played on the piano. Now we've shown this in trailers, so I don't mind talking about this. Basically, if you stay still for too long, a shroud of darkness gets you. So you have to keep moving from one light source to another. So in the Shadows of Moldwood, there's constant tension, but also Mora's melody plays on piano at various points throughout that environment. Then in the boss fight, you get obviously the dramatic version of Mora's melody. And then in the Eyes of the Forest and the Darkness Lifted, you get a different version of Mora's melody, kind of implied in the title what it might be. And that was just, as you can kind of gather, like that's about like 40% of the soundtrack just covered with character themes alone. And there's so many bits and pieces of the game where Shriek's theme pops up. Just for gameplay and narrative reasons, Orku's theme pops up, and it was nice to be able to have a bigger bank of material to drop into the game when I needed to. Of course, one has to come up with the themes first and hope that they're good, but I never got any pushback from the team, and when I never get any pushback, I assume they're good. Because Moon is a team of 80 people now. Wow. So there's a lot of people who can give feedback. And no one really raised any doubts. It was fun to really explore different melodies and see how much I could develop them. Because a lot of these, for example, Quolok's character arc takes place over two acts of the game. So it was really interesting to be able to like take a theme and stretch it out a bit more. Obviously, Ori's theme is prevalent throughout the soundtrack, but not as prevalent as it was in the first game. Which meant that when I did need to use it, which at its most prominent, I would say, is in Shriek and Ori, which doesn't take a genius to work out. That's the final boss fight. But in the second half of that track, you get probably what I would say is the most emphatic version of Ori's theme. It was just kind of fun to like really be able to use it when it actually mattered this time.
Well, did you know the whole story arc before you even started writing the music so that you could craft themes for all these characters and then work out how you could make them, you know, play nicely together?
I knew the characters. The story took a while to come together. Like the team went back and forth a lot on the story because it's quite a different story from Blind Forest. If Blind Forest is a child taking its first steps in the world, this is like more like, hey, this is what real life's actually like. So it's definitely. The analogy I like to use is Ori's grown up, but also Moon Studios has grown up, and I would say I've grown up as a composer. Like if I wrote Blind Forest today, it would be totally different to probably what the Blind Forest score was in 2015, and we'll never know if that was a good thing or a bad thing, and that's fine. But Will of the Wisps is definitely it's definitely a slightly heavier in tone story, and I think that's taken a few people by surprise because I think a lot of people were expecting Ori 1.5. Let's just have the same kind of thing with the same platforming and the same kind of wistful music, but once you start playing the game, it becomes clear that like the exact same kind of musical approach where it's like super light the whole time isn't actually appropriate for the gameplay. There are spots in the game where a lighter touch is totally needed, but overall the theme and tone is slightly darker. As that pertains to the story, I mean, really, I just go back and forth with the story team and see how bits and pieces get put together based on the overall framework, and some things come online sooner than others. So we kind of knew the overall story arc from the very beginning. So we kind of, knew where we want to start, knew where we want to finish, and then how we get there is the bit that took quite some time to figure out. But it feels like we landed in a pretty good place.
Oh, absolutely. I've just so been enjoying the music. And, just like with Blind Forest, your music has to do a lot of the emotional heavy lifting. And one of the first big surprises I got was when Howl shows up. I mean, you see him kind of skulking there in the background, and then all of a sudden, bam, he's right there. And it's terrifying. And the way you use the chorus for that sequence is just, it's brilliant. And it's just, it really obviously got my attention, got me scared, which is probably the intent, but...
Well, it was funny. We, because we talked about boss fights, and it's not that sequence isn't really a boss fight, but it kind of prepares you for what's coming. It's kind of like a little teaser. But yeah, basically, for most people, that takes place 10 minutes into the game, pretty much 10-15 minutes, and it's quite an impressive way to open. We really wanted to be like, all right, you're really in it now. And you referenced the choir. I mean, it's funny. It really is just a choir yelp. It's one of the most easiest things to notate. But what I actually didn't think of that until like super late in the process, like long after we'd recorded. Actually, I think I put that in on February the 1st. I put in an echo on the choir yelp. And that gave it like the it was already creepy, but I wanted one thing to make it slightly creepier. yeah, it's kind of is a little bit of a jolt to the system. And yeah, I think when I saw that we were doing that in the first 10 minutes of the game, I was like, wow, we're doing a chase sequence and little boss fight. Okay, that's we're going all out.
Yeah, definitely. How much time did you have to kind of craft what would ultimately be the instrumentation?
I mean, I've been on and off this project. I would say I've been on it full time for the last 12 to 14 months. But I was on and off the project throughout 2017 and 2018, keeping an eye on, you know, how the game develops. I'm always around the project, but I'm not writing music constantly. But I was never far away from it. So I kind of knew how things were developing. I'm seeing all the concept art come in, and I'm seeing the gameplay come online. So I'm familiar. When it came to actually starting the process of doing all the writing, I'd kind of made a lot of decisions in my head already. I'll use the Shadows of Moldwood track as an example, just because I think it's one of the most unique tracks in the Ori musical universe, because we don't really do horror. And I'm like, well, what would horror sound like in the Ori musical universe? Because we're not going to do the typical super screechy strings. So it's like, how can I make the strings feel tense and scary without resorting to the usual horror music tropes? And we basically came up with these string designs where so when you have a string section, normally it's violin one, violin two, viola, cello, and bass. And that's basically five musical lines. But what we did, instead of having just violin one and two, we did violin 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. And they were all doing slightly different variations of the same very simple idea. And they were playing them slightly out of time or slightly out of tune. And I ended up with this rather impressive library of string sounds that perfectly encapsulated something that was constantly moving or shimmering away in the background. And that's kind of what you hear throughout in the background on Shadows of Moldwood.
Thank you.
And that idea just came from hearing about the gameplay for the first time with the shroud of darkness that envelops you if you stay still for too long. I wanted something that would like make you feel tense the longer you stayed still. And I was able to do it without going to something that was atonal and dissonant. It's still tonal, but it's also creepy. That was probably one of the more, most people don't like the spider area because it is creepy, but that was probably for me one of the more fun environments to work on, just because we've never done something as dark as that in an Ori game before.
Yeah, in fact, I'm trying to think here when I've ever heard any of your music that sounds as dark as that, and I can't think of anything. So.
I honestly haven't had the opportunity. I mean, even on Darksiders Genesis, it's just a very, that's in theory should be a dark game, but it isn't. It's just a very over the top action game. No, this I would say is probably one of the most unsettling things I've ever written. It was kind of satisfying to know that I could even do that, and then of course being able to hear it live, like hearing the strings do the creepy stuff at Air Studios in London was unbelievable. To answer your question, like overall question about the instrumentation, because I literally could go through every environment and it would take forever because there are so many environments. It's just a process for each environment, and it's kind of the same process each time. The longer I spend, the more time I spend with that environment, the more the answers become clear to me. And this is where the benefit of being attached to a game, even if I'm not working directly on it, the benefit of being attached to a game for a long time is that I have a deep understanding of what the game needs when it becomes time to press the accelerate button.
Wow, that's such a great way of working. And it's a real luxury to have that amount of time too, because so often the music, it's not really an afterthought, but it's a thing that doesn't really get added until the game is basically almost baked and done. So that's so cool. Well, I would love to talk with you about some of the musicians that you worked with. I mean, Kristen Negus, who played 21 different wind instruments. She is just amazing. And so she's worked on other game soundtracks for you, and she's worked for other composers too. So I'm sure she was like top of the list for this kind of thing, right?
Yeah, I mean, she's become a force of nature in the last couple of years. I mean, I feel like she's on just about everything. She's like the go-to woodwind specialist at the moment, and you know, it's a game that's set in a forest. It certainly needs some woodwinds. But I think it's also, she has a greater knowledge of woodwind instruments than I ever will. It's useful. It's not just her. It's just useful in general to have musicians to bounce ideas off of, because they know their instruments better than composers do. Any composer who claims that they can play an instrument better than an actual instrumentalist is nuts. So it's always useful to me to use real musicians as a resource or for research. And I'd often send a melody to Kristen and say, this is the context. Although I had to give her limited context because she's a fan of the game and didn't want the story spoiled, which I did manage to achieve,
wow.
Even though she plays on like 30 of the tracks. I'd give her a melody and I'd just say, can you, you know, just play this on several instruments and tell me which one you think is best. And I usually ended up agreeing with her. There were a few where I just chose something different, but you know, she'd always give me options. And she'd give me instruments that I'd never heard of before. She'd surprise me with a sound, and I'm like, "What is that?" And she'd say it's recorder, and I'm like, "Recorder? I hate the recorder." sound not like a recorder. The best example of that is in Lumipools, which track 34. There's a recorder solo in there, and it just doesn't sound like a recorder to me. Thank you. I'm still suspicious it's not actually a recorder, but she tells me it is. So, yeah, I mean, yeah, she played a variety of whistles, whistles, recorders, ethnic flutes. She used her fujara, which is a massive Slovakian flute that is like 8 foot tall. Yeah, there's a whole variety of instruments. But another cool thing that she did, that I asked her to do, I had her record a bunch of what I would like to call like flurries, or what might be easier to, what's the word I could use that would easier describe them? Intros and outros. So like little bursts of woodwind sounds, and you hear them all over the soundtrack, and also some of the pickup sounds. So they can be like little jingles, and they're very good for like transitions. So every so often, like it's not really a woodwind solo. It's just like you'll hear a little woodwind flurry in the background, and it was a very useful color to have. She recorded like something insane, like 1,000 different little flurries for me. I'm like, okay, you didn't need to record that many, but she recorded them on a bunch of different flutes. So, like maybe it was like 70 different sounds on 13 different instruments or something like that. I can't remember the numbers, but like it was useful to have a library of sounds that, I mean, I'll be honest, I literally dragged and dropped them into some transitional spots on the soundtrack, and then made sure they matched the key of the music. And I'm like, well, that's a nice little color to have there. It's never in your face, but it's just like, it reminds you that there's like a strong woodwind element to the score, as well as the woodwind that's actually in the orchestra. Yeah, she really was a tour de force on this project. And it would be a very different sounding game without her work.
Oh yeah. Did she go along with you to London for some of the recording sessions?
She didn't. I actually thought about it. So the main thing is, because I use Kristen conceptually as well, basically all the material that she needed to record was done.
Oh.
by the time we went to London. I think it'd be one of those things, like, because Ori is a highly, highly conceptual work in terms of how the music is approached, I often have her play, she's often part of my ideas from a very early stage. Whereas if I, let's say I've been doing this score traditionally and came on at the end, then absolutely I would have probably had her come to London. But I mean, she is really like, you know, part of the concepting stage. So yeah, like on Separated by the Storm, the English horn melody she plays, I mean, that was recorded in 2017. That was actually the first piece of music that was completed for the game.
Thank you.
And at the time, I didn't know that that was going to morph into Ku's theme, because that theme, if you listen carefully to the theme in Separated by the Storm, it's the minor version of Ku's theme, which you hear in track 2, 3, 4, and 5. Yeah, at the time, though, I didn't know it. It was written for a completely different context. Sometimes themes kind of appear out of nowhere when you least expect them, or you just don't see it until it's like... until you suddenly have the light bulb moment.
That must be a great feeling. And then to know that you've got the perfect thing right there, and it was right there all along.
It was right there all along. I just wish it hadn't taken me so long to like actually see it, because I only discovered that in like 2019, 2 years down the line. So it didn't end up mattering, but like I had done some alternates for Ku's theme, but it wasn't quite working. It just turned out that I was trying to do too much, and I was like, well, let's take a look at let's take a look at some other melodies in the game. And that was the first one I looked at. I was like, well, narratively, this actually might make sense if I can make this work, because the cue is Separated by the Storm, which is, you know, it's the end of the prologue. Ori and Ku get separated. So I was like, well, it's going to be, if this was the sad version of Ku's theme, what would the happy version sound like? And I was able to make it work. And I was like, well, there's my answer. But yeah, I just didn't think of it until that time. But I'm glad I did.
Yeah. Well, that's sort of like a kind of mirrors my experience in the game, because I tend to get to a place and I can't exactly figure out how I'm supposed to move around and scale up walls and stop until it finally dawns on me. But what I've noticed is that the music is never repetitive, no matter how long I spend, you know, hitting a branch and falling back down again or whatever. it never gets old. So how were you able to do that?
Well, I mean, the first answer to that is long loops. Most of the looped tracks are at least 3 minutes, 30 seconds, which coincidentally is the length of your average pop song, mm-hmm. which coincidentally is how I structure most of my tracks. Most of them are verse, chorus, bridge. You'll find exceptions all over the place, but like, that is the pop song format is still, in my opinion, the best way to write music. I'm not writing like thinking, oh, I must write a great pop song. It's really just about how to structure the ideas. Like, if you call the verse section A, then the chorus section B, and then you've got your two sections, and you can just repeat them in a slightly different way. And because you're always morphing through the different sections, you're never feeling quite like you're stuck in the same place the whole time. Now, there is another aspect to it. It's that the music is never really in your face during the regular moment-to-moment gameplay. The music only gets really big when it absolutely needs to, and that's a highly deliberate decision. Because you do spend a lot of time platforming. You know, if we used combat music every time you're fighting like a one-off monster, you're going to be in and out of combat music so quickly it will actually break immersion, because the music will feel gimmicky. We only use combat music when you have to kill something to progress. So early on in the game, you have these little mini sequences where you might get gated into an area and you have to kill like two monsters to advance. That's when we use like a little combat cue. Obviously, the boss fights, they need combat cues. But generally, the chase sequences have combat cues because, dramatic music, because they need to be dramatic. But overall, I don't want to interrupt the flow of the game by making the music too in your face. So the other thing that probably makes it feel less repetitive is that the music is a fairly similar dynamic range throughout all of the regular environment loops. Even though there may be a chorus, it's never that much louder than what the verse section of the track might be. So I wish I could give you a more concrete answer, because I have to be honest, I don't it's something I always worry about, like, oh, is my music going to get repetitive if people are stuck in the area? I will say this, though, I have written a lot more music this time around, which is shown by the length of the soundtrack.
Yeah.
Probably the biggest difference in this game is that apart from one environment, the sanctuary area, every environment has multiple pieces of music attached to it. So In the Inkwater Marsh, the opening area, you have the initial cue. There's actually an intro cue as Ori wakes up. Then you have that's the intro you only hear one time, you never hear it again. Then you have the regular gameplay loop that plays all the way up until you have the chase with Hal. Then there's a moment of silence, which is deeply shocking because we never have silence in Ori. But then you pick up the sword. This is all still fairly early on in the game, so it's not really spoiling. Mm-hmm. Then you pick up the sword. And then after you pick up the sword, you get a variation of that initial melody in Separated by the Storm. The track on the album is Now Use the Light We Want to See. I've forgotten the name of my own track. but I'm going to have to look it up now. Because there's so many. That's the real problem. Now Use the Light We Want to See. Yeah, so that the melody is basically the same as Separated by the Storm, but it has a more peppy accompaniment because it's like the first moment of positivity you've had in a while.
Thank you.
It's slightly similar to Up the Spirit Cavern's Walls from Blind Forest. Before you pick up Wall Jump, the music in the Spirit Caverns is low tempo, and then after you pick up the Wall Jump ability, the music changes to be slightly more high tempo. This is a similar concept, but it still uses the same dark melody, because you're still searching, it's dark Ku melody, because you're still searching for Ku, but now you have a sword, so like at least it gives you a bit more impetus. And then as you progress out of the Inkwater Marsh in A Shine Upon Inkwater Marsh, you start to see sunlight, and then you get like a slightly more uplifting version of that same core melody that you've heard throughout the Inkwater Marsh. So I've used, I like to call them switches. I don't change music on the fly during the game. I look for moments where I can literally switch the music and the player hopefully won't notice. So for example, when transitioning from Now Use the Light We Want to See to A Shine Upon Inkwater Marsh, that transition doesn't happen until you've opened a specific keystone door that will advance the story. So all of that stuff is prevalent throughout the game, and we probably could not have done it on the first game because it requires an incredible amount of technical support, because you've got to track what the player is doing. And you got to track like later on in the game, like what music plays when the player warps back to the Inkwater Marsh after they've explored the entire map and are still visiting the area. Do you still want the sad Ku melody to be playing, or do you want the upbeat music to be playing? There's a lot of tracking of what the player has done in order to get the right music to play in the right environment. But for this game, we did have the tech support to be able to do that, which means I could be a little bit more granular in the music approach and how it was implemented, which is another contributing factor to why you might not find it repetitive. It's a combination of things. It's the approach to the music. It's the relatively similar dynamic range within the regular environment loops, and it's also how it's implemented in the game.
Wow, it's just fascinating, and the end result is just this incredible world that you get to spend time in that the music supports, and it must almost feel a little bit like you're writing a theme in variations, honestly, with all of the variants and the different way you can approach it and stuff. And
yeah, I mean, the basically a lot of the environments are mini suites. Like if we take the Silent Woodlands, which is tracks 24, 25, 26, I mean, they all use the same palette. So I'm not like changing up the instrumentation, but it is three tracks, so it kind of feels like a mini suite. The same with Quolok's music that starts the Eyes of Quolok, track 11 through tracks 12, 13, 14, and 15, and 16. They all use kind of a similar palette. So it might like look like a lot of tracks, but they are all actually part of the same overall idea, because if I had to come up with a new palette for 60 tracks, I would probably go crazy because it would just be too much. So the same with the spider. It's, you know, once I've decided the palette, like it's kind of, you kind of have to stay consistent. So I think your theme and variations analogy is good. All of these are kind of mini suites where hopefully the music doesn't sound the same from one track to the next, but each one sounds like a development of the last.
Yeah, that's exactly how it sounds. And in addition to using Kristen and her incredible zoo of instruments, you also brought in Aralee Brighton again. And she just has the most amazing voice. And it's just, she has so much humanity and such a beautiful quality for her voice. And so it must have been fun to work with her again.
Yes. It was great to bring her back. I think I'd have been in trouble if I didn't bring her back, to be honest. One of the things that I'm really glad we did for this game. You fire up the game and the main menu is also the first scene of the game. Like it literally transitions immediately. So I'm like, great, I can actually use the main menu music as the opening, like the opening little bit of gameplay in the prologue as well, because a lot of people who played the game for the who played Blind Forest, you know, a lot of people like dying to get into Ori, and they like speed through the opening logos and everything and press start immediately, and you hear like 10 seconds of the menu theme and you're into the game, which is great if you want to get started quickly. But I think a lot of people didn't actually hear the full menu music, whereas this time you actually cannot reach the next scene until you've heard a full cycle of the entire melody at least once. That was actually a really cool solution to get people to like. I've heard it described many times as a warm blanket. Like you start up the game and it feels familiar.
Yeah.
So because it is obviously it is a different version of the main theme. It's the same melody. It's a very different arrangement. It's in a different key, but it's fitting for the opening. It's Ori's watching the sunset, and it's both reflective, but I also think it's a slight precursor for what's to come. But so she is also in the flight sequence, which is the moment in the prologue, and I kind of knew very very early on that. That we were going to use her for the flight sequence, and she's also in the final track for reasons I won't go into because you need to play the game to find out why. but to get back to her voice, she does bring a unique quality. I mean, she has pipes that no one else has. No one, I don't know anyone else that has been blessed with vocal cords quite like she has. It's interesting in this one because this game it is different in tone to the first game, and I think her voice is reflective, or in the first game, of Ori's like uncovering of you know, a child steps into the first world, whereas the dark tone of the second game meant I leaned on the choir, the group of voices more, but it also meant that when I dropped Aerely's voice at the end, and I've seen enough reactions now on Twitch and YouTube to know that I was right, that it had the absolute maximum impact that I intended. It was just kind of another example of also a different approach. But yeah, it was great to have her back.
Yeah,
especially in the opening. Yeah,
and it's just so great because you didn't overuse her either. So when we do have a chance to hear her, it's just like, it's magical. It's just really cool. You know, it has been so much fun to talk with you over the years about your Minecraft soundtracks for Egyptian mythology and Greek mythology and Chinese. And I'm just wondering how much of that kind of infused the sound of this soundtrack for certain areas, because it does sound a little bit you know, multicultural, I guess. There are some sounds that kind of sound a little bit like a gamelan, and burrowing sounds very Middle Eastern.
Yeah, I mean, when I saw the desert area, I mean, I'm not afraid to say that I kind of reverted to the fairly typical approach. But again, there's the vocabulary that one can use, but I also think my own production style and how I use reverb and how I arrange for the orchestra. I think that's what makes Ori sound like Ori. So yes, it can. I can definitely see the links between Egyptian mythology and the desert for sure. But also the Norse mythology is a good reference for the winter area of the game, which is Bower's Reach. And actually, initially there, I recorded Hardanger Fiddle, but I really wanted to use it. But when I put it in game, it just wasn't right. Like Hardanger Fiddle is too harsh of a sound for Ori. It just didn't work, and I was like, damn, I can't put it in. We ended up just going back to woodwind, you know, Kristen was just fine with that. I would say all of those Minecraft soundtracks definitely, because of the amount of research that I did in making them, I wouldn't say I actively referenced them, but I think it just gave me a bank of knowledge to draw on subconsciously when coming up for ideas for these areas. But for example, the winter area, like the harmony and melody lines are quite Nordic, but then you have all of the twinkly bell sounds, which are absolutely nowhere near the Norse mythology the Norse mythology soundtracks, because that would have been inappropriate for what we were doing with that. But twinkly bells, especially with the whole Northern Lights theme that we have going, especially towards the end of the wintry area, it was highly appropriate. Yeah, I definitely would say a process of osmosis. It just kind of naturally happened, that probably some work from the past kind of seeped its way into this soundtrack. Just like my work on Will of the Wisps will probably seep into whatever I'm doing next. That's kind of just the way it goes as a composer, I think.
Sure, yeah. Well, it's got to be really tough to keep things separate and sort of put things in a box so that, especially if you're working on two projects simultaneously, there's no like cross contamination. So, yeah, it must be. I suppose it's unavoidable, really. But
it can happen. I mean, at the same time, I think all composers have styles. Like Thomas Newman has a style, and it can be recognizable in. It can be recognizable in like instrumentation. Like, I mean, how many times have we heard the Thomas Newman piano with the soft string accompaniment? Like, it's just what he does, and he does it very well, and he still is able to do a twist on it each time. You know, I think all composers who you're seeing getting rehired on different projects, it's because they have a sound that you know is recognizable, or people can say like, oh, that sounds like you know, that sounds like that composer, or that sounds like that composer. It can almost feel like a safety net. Like, you know, you're getting a certain sound when you hire a certain composer. So I think a little bit of cross-contamination is not necessarily a bad thing, because it does mean you also have a sound. The hard thing where the line has to kind of like stop is like, okay, you can recycle some things, but you can't recycle everything. And if, you know, if you're doing your job right, you are just always going to be learning new stuff. Like how I learned on the Shadows of Moldwood track that I could, you know, really get in there and do some creepy stuff.
Yeah, I bet. Well, I'm just curious about, from a sort of, I guess, workflow aspect, this is such a huge project to wrangle. So, I mean, how did you stay on top of it all?
With great difficulty, to be honest. The last, I would say, from September 2019 through the end of January 2020 was particularly challenging, because things were, you know, things were really starting to come together, and then you're making lots of tweaks in a very short period of time, but you're also having to start, the orchestration process. You're having to start prepping, you know, getting the music ready for all the musicians. You have to prepare all the, you know, all of the project files so that things can actually be recorded. You have to, you have to decide the final orchestra lineup, even though all the tracks aren't written yet. I didn't realize how good at organization I was, even though it felt hectic. I was always on the edge with time. It still all got done. I definitely learned from my experience on Blind Forest, where I literally did everything myself, which I'm on record as saying that was very stupid.
Yeah, I remember that GDC session.
Yep. And I delegated a lot this time. I had a very, very, very amazing team that helped me throughout. I had Alex Rudd conducting for me. That's been a staple forever. Zach Lemon, who's supervising orchestrator on this, he's been with me forever. The two newbies, they've worked for me before, but definitely not on anything this substantial. David Peacock and Eric Buchholz literally did all of the physical notation work and orchestration, which then got passed to Zach to proofread. And it's 186 minutes on the soundtrack, but there's even more in the game.
Wow.
So I would say it's you know, not that much more, but you know, there's stuff in there that got recorded for sure. And it's just an insane amount of music that that David and Eric got prepped. It really does take a lot of people to be able to produce a soundtrack that's this substantial. I'm glad people have recognized that it's a pretty substantial work. But you know, length isn't everything. It's still got to feel good in the game, and that's also really, really important. It seems to have been received well. I'm actually pleasantly surprised that most of the reviews and comments I'm getting from people who have played it feel like that it's a stronger soundtrack than the first game. But I really don't care. It's actually not for me to decide. If, you know, I think there are going to be some people that like the first soundtrack better, because it's not even because it might be a better soundtrack, but because it was the first time experience and it was so new. And nothing, nothing can ever beat the first time experience. But also, I think some people will have come into the second game expecting a certain thing, and then not just the music, but then this game just definitely isn't Ori 1.5. Like, it's we were very ambitious, and we really tried very hard to obviously make it feel true to the world of Ori, but also make it feel like a true sequel. But yeah, sorry, back to the wrangling. Like, I just, I mean, without the team of brilliant people, I mean, the credits list in the music section of the game is quite long. I could have been really silly and listed all 92 musicians who performed on the on the recording, but I didn't. It really is a massive group effort.
Yeah. Wow. Well, it really shows. It's just so polished and so diverse, and the soundtrack, just, I love how it follows the arc of the story, and it's just, it takes you on a journey, which is so cool. And I'm just wondering, you know, what were some of the best things about working on the soundtrack?
I think an easy place to start is the addition of the boss fights. I obviously have quite a lot of experience now doing boss fights thanks to Ark. Mm-hmm. Like Ark kind of like gave me an opportunity to like learn that process of how to make things feel epic. But one of the things I'm most proud of is our boss fights are multi-stage, and also the music is multi-stage. So when you get the enemy below a certain HP, hit point value, the music transitions. So there's a transitional piece. So there's the initial piece when you start the fight. Then there's a transitional piece when you get the enemy below a certain HP. And then that transitional piece leads seamlessly into the final bit. And my general approach, I'll use the Moira of the Spider for an example, because it's right on the soundtrack and it's literally all in there. There's the intro. That's actually a separate cue. So it's actually the intro, and then the first combat phase. And the first combat phase is like dark and heavy. It is designed to make you feel like you're in trouble. The transitional phase is usually a mini chase sequence. And I use the mini chase sequence just to transition the music. And then once you've got gotten the boss to below that certain HP, the music changes seamlessly into something that's more optimistic, that makes you believe, oh, you can do it, and yes, you're fighting back.
Thank you.
because I didn't want the same vibe throughout all of the boss fights. This is most obvious in the More of the Spider track and Shriek and Ori. Like you'll hear clear shifts in from the first half to the second half. And yeah, like so each boss fight really has an intro, combat phase one, transition, combat phase two, and then an outro. And they're all kind of like mini suites, and I'm so glad we're able to make it work. Honestly, when we first came up with the idea of boss fights, I was like, how are you guys gonna even do this in 2D? Because it's there's so many limits to what you can do with the camera in a side scroller. Like, how are you going to make this work? But somehow they did. And I was like, well, this is great, because now I get to have a ton of fun. So yeah, obviously it was nice to revisit the chase sequences again, but my approach for the chase sequences, man, I mean, this was difficult because it's one of those things. If you, I feel like I could have just simply reused restoring the light facing the dark and people would have been thrilled, but it was discussed in the team, and pretty much everyone felt that it was too cheap and that Ori 1 is its own thing and it's done, so we're not reusing material. Now we do like reference that piece, but the feel is very different. And also the chase sequences in this game, what my thinking of it was, taking Ori's point of view, Ori's done chase sequences. He did a bunch of them in the first game. It's kind of old news to him. and I'm not saying that these situations aren't like incredibly dangerous, but it's a different state of mind. Now, whether the player feels that, I don't know, but that was like my thinking behind it. So the chase sequences do feel, I think they feel a little bit less dangerous. They're still exciting to play, but I felt that when playing the game, obviously, not everyone's played Ori 1, but contextually, if Ori was doing these chase sequences, he would have more confidence than when he was doing them literally for the first time in Blind Forest. Whereas the boss fights are utterly terrifying for Ori because he's literally never seen creatures this big before, other than Kuro, and the last big creature, and obviously Kuro being the last big creature that Ori saw, that's pretty terrifying. So that was kind of my approach for the chase sequences this time. And I think, again, I could go through all of the tracks, to be honest, because I have such a strong attachment to all of them. But I think we did a lot more with cutscenes and in-game storytelling this time. I've referenced Ash and Bone from the soundtrack. The ending of the game is literally a 6, maybe even 7-minute cutscene, and it's all seamless, and there's a little bit of gameplay in it as well. I'm very proud of how that all came together. And with all the tech that we had, in terms of supporting how the music plays back, it was just nice to be able to really get things more seamless than before in terms of the storytelling, aspect of the game. And I just want to give a shout out to Guy Whitmore, who is a composer, but he's also one of the implementation gods of the game music world. And he was literally the person doing all of the implementing for me on this game. He was hired as part of the sound team. He was also doing all of the ambiences in the game and a bunch of other stuff, but he was the one that got assigned to implement the crazy amount of music that I gave him, but it ended up working out really well, because I know if I'd been doing it, it would be a mess. yes, I feel I've referred to him as the game music development cheat code.
Well, there's just there, yeah, and I know what you mean, because there is just a wonderful moment right in the very beginning where the music totally matches Koo's little baby Koo hopping to Ori, and it's such a perfect moment, and it's so perfect I didn't even notice it at first until you mentioned it in an earlier interview, and then I went back and watched it again, and I was like, yeah, it's just amazing.
You know, it's funny how many times that scene got redone. I had to like slightly shift it. I'm like, guys, can you stop changing the animation of this scene? Because that means I have to redo the math every single time. But yeah, it was funny because doing that like Tom and Jerry thing isn't really very Ori. Normally we're not that on the nose, but I'm like, come on, it is actually kind of a Tom and Jerry moment. Like, this awkward looking owl hopping across the screen, and Gummo's such a ridiculous looking character that it felt appropriate to do something like that. It's nice to have it's nice to be able to trust that things also will stay in sync, because doing this would be a whole nother podcast. I could talk about this, but keeping things in sync when you're rendering cutscenes in the game as opposed to them being pre-rendered and just playing back is an absolute nightmare to keep things in sync. Like, it's I won't bore you with all the technical details, but let's just say it's hard. It requires like a lot of planning and chopping up of long queues to give them like anchor points. I will explain it briefly because I've kind of teased it now.
Okay.
If you have a 3 minute long cutscene, let's say you're playing on a slightly slower PC. Your PC might not be able to keep up with rendering the visuals, and then the music might gradually drift. So the way we avoid that is to chop that 3 minute music cue. First of all, you have to find appropriate places to chop. Usually it's at the end of a phrase or at the end of a verse or chorus, as I kind of hinted at earlier. And you use that as kind of like the end point. And then at that like end point, if the PC, the slightly slower PC, is out of sync, it can then play phrase two of the music at the correct spot. So then you're back in sync again. So for a lot of the longer cutscenes, we chop things up to give the cutscene music multiple anchor points, which again is not something we could do on the first game.
Wow, that's fascinating. All these things that, you know, we never notice as a player.
Well, if it's done well, then you hopefully will never notice it.
Yeah. Well, the digital version is out right now, and it's just, yeah, it's such a generous soundtrack. But there's also a vinyl release that IM 8-Bit is producing, and it looks absolutely gorgeous.
Yep. Delighted to be working with them again, both on Will of the Wisps and a reprint of Blind Forest, which people have been crying out for because it sold out quite quickly, I think, the first time round. I guess I can plug it, because these two vinyls are designed to be displayed back to back on your shelf. They do work in tandem. The artists worked together to make sure of a consistent design on if you put them on your shelf. But I can tell you, one of the hardest things I've had to do is to cut the soundtrack down for two LPs.
Oh.
My goodness, that was hard. Because I mean, the thing is, and I'm not saying there won't be like a super deluxe edition down the line. Like, who knows? Who knows what could happen down the line? Because I think anything, with the success of the game, anything is on the table right now. But for now, it's I still managed to get like something from every environment on the soundtrack. So it is actually still a decent reflection of the overall story. But cutting it down to, I think, 80 minutes from 186, like, I was like, wow, there's going to be some brutal cuts here. So it's as much a cutting as it is, I would say, a composer's choice of like, not my favorite tunes from the soundtrack, but it's my favorite tunes from the soundtrack that also reflect the entire, most of the story. I hope, I don't know, obviously don't know when, what the dates are, but it is available to pre-order now on the website. It's a really, really nice package that they've put together.
It looks amazing. I've taken a look at it on their site, and it's just gorgeous. And we've covered a lot, but is there anything that I missed that you want people to know about?
I think overall, like, this was such, this does feel like a closing of a chapter for me, because I think this soundtrack represents pretty much everything I've learned since I started working in the industry. And it has been interesting reading feedback on it, because like I hinted at earlier, while a lot of people liked it, I think we did take some risks with this second game, and a lot of people were not expecting exactly what we did. You know, the soundtrack is heavier than the first game, and I think people were expecting the same light touch, and it just isn't that, because it isn't that game. Although if they want the light touch, just go listen to Luma Pools. It's there. it's just it is just a very different game, and it is truly a sequel. We've been emphasizing that from the beginning, and I am delighted that it has been received so well by the press. I'm obviously delighted that so many people are playing it, because with the unfortunate circumstances of the virus situation at the moment, there's record numbers of people on Steam and Xbox, and it's actually kind of a good time to release a video game because everyone's at home.
Well, and especially this one too, because it has
right. Just, this is the game. Maybe this is the game that people needed. And obviously, today we've got Animal Crossing, and you've got two moods today, because it's Animal Crossing and Doom Eternal's like out in 2 days. So like whatever you want, like it's probably there for you. If you want to go and kill some demons to Mick Gordon's epic metal soundtrack, you totally can. If you want to play Animal Crossing, you totally can. If you want to play Ori and have an emotional experience, you totally can. It's actually, I think, because there are a couple of other games. I think in the last 2 weeks, there have been 5 games rated 87 or above on Metacritic, which is absolutely insane. So it's been quite, and they're all different. It's been quite a crazy week for game, a couple of weeks for gaming. In what is going to be quite a crazy year for gaming, with everything that's coming up. Like you said, I mean, maybe this is the game that people need at this time, especially as it's not one of those, it's not an 80-hour, 100-hour extravaganza. Like, you can finish it in, you know, depending on your ability, 2 to 3 days, and depending on how many hours you put in a day. So it is an experience you can play and finish and then move on. I still don't get bored of seeing people's reactions on Twitch and YouTube. That's ultimately why we're doing what we're doing. We want to see people enjoying our work. We want to see people getting sad. We want to see people having fun with the combat, enjoying the art, enjoying the music. And yes, we do also want to see the criticism, because we all learn from it. And if there's one thing I learned from this project, is it's don't try to please everyone, because it's impossible, especially doing a sequel. Like, because we weren't invisible this time, we were never ever going to meet everyone's expectations. So I think what happened is we stayed true to what we believed was best for the game. And I think that's come across in the final game. We stayed true to what we wanted to do, rather than listen to too much of the outside stuff. Yes, we do take feedback on board, but much of it is incorporated into the game. But there's also some things where, like, we're pretty emphatic. You know, we're gonna do this the Moon Studios way.
Yeah, it's just such an amazing experience, and Gareth, it has been so much fun to do this really, really deep dive, and look under the hood at the whole process. So thank you so much.
Thank you. I'm glad I was able to get in. This is definitely the most in-depth I've done a chat on. Well, this is hardly a chat, but on Will of the Wisps soundtrack. So thank you.